always a case study on that. So, like, you gotta know your drugs to do well, and know your drug interactions. Don't forget, know both brand and generic so you'll be able to recognize it. I'll always give you the structure and either the brand name or the generic name. You usually have to pick from a limited formulary which drug you would choose, give you a patient, a scenario, stuff like that. Well, most of the stuff we talked a lot about, if you have specific questions, come and see me this week. I'm around most of the week. So drop in. The only thing that we didn't technically get to the actual lecture, but we talked about it in a lot of other aspects, are the BARBs. And like I said, on Friday, I believe, the BARBs, we talked about the clinically used ones as reducing agents and with epilepsy. So outside of that, rarely do you see a BARB being used besides, oh, you know what, though? I'm going to give you guys a handout because I think I had this handout in the BARB lecture, and I don't know if it's in your packet. Did you guys remember a long time ago I said I was going to talk about Furoset? Did I talk to you guys about it?
No.
Is it in your packet? Okay. So I will give you, I'm going to make a, some handouts. I'll make myself a note. And I will put it outside my door. We're going to have a brief talk about Furoset, and that's the only other thing that we're going to talk about from BARBs. Furoset is just a drug that's a BARB derivative, and it's only useful for mild pain. Okay? So remember when we talked about with migraines, some people are putting patients on Furoset? Not a good idea. Okay? Because only if somebody has very mild, mild pain would you ever put somebody on Furoset. Furoset also has some of the similar side effects that you would see typically with your BARB derivatives. And so sometimes people can be feeling a little spaced out, maybe sedative effects or stuff like that. So it's really not effective for true migraine pain, and it's definitely not effective for anything like clusters or anything like that. But you do see some people dispensing Furoset out of ignorance, I guess, because it's not going to affect or help migraine pain, okay? So I guess that's the only thing out of the BARB section additionally that I was going to talk about, because that's also going to be fairly commonly dispensed relative to that, okay? And you can read through the notes that I'll have on that. But that's about it. All right, do you guys have any specific questions for what to expect? Do you get a sense of what to expect then? Okay, good. So study it that way. And study, like, what's the problem? Like, what are we studying? What's the big issue? Okay, start to get specific. What drugs do I have available? When would I want to use this drug? When would I want to use this drug? Or what if I have a hypertensive patient? Okay, what are some drug interactions? How might I counsel and recommend some other things for this patient? Sometimes we talked about supplements. We talked about the lack of effectiveness of some supplements, back and forth. So, like, always think clinical relevance and clinical significance, because that's what you're going to have to know anyway. So it's pretty much good for you even by the time you get to therapeutics. You'll remember it a lot.
How old do you want to know the database? You want to know the name, what
If I made you know the name, you guys would all fail. I'm just being honest, okay? You need to know the basic metabolism where we talked about it. The biggest aspect of metabolism where we got into talking about it was with the anesthetics, okay? So, you know, local anesthetics, if they get hydrolyzed a lot, right? The metabolites, we talked about what's the most important metabolite, and if it has the ability to form that metabolite, etc., i.e. metabolite. With general anesthetics, we talk about the basic metabolism and how they get broken down and how we try and avoid that and try and make them more stable. Hence, that's why we talk about a lot of the different substitutions you would make around, like, the ether derivatives or something like that. But outside of that, you don't need to memorize every type of metabolite and the name of the metabolite. Otherwise, you'd have no hope, okay? Plus, how would that help you as a pharmacist? Well, I understand we have different styles, but my style is I want you to understand the drugs very well and understand the clinical relevance of the chemistry to it where it's applicable. Are we all on the same page? Okay, that's what I want you to learn. I understand the studying will be a little bit different, but try and think what everybody would think, right? What they're going to ask you. Okay, well, why would I want to take this? Here's a scenario. They're taking this, this, and this. All right, you have these drugs to choose from. Which one would you choose? Okay? The nature of a test like this means, oh, great, Dr. Bontrager's test is so hard. It's not that much harder. It's just you got to study a little differently, right? But you're going to retain the knowledge so much longer. And plus, isn't it interesting? Don't you want to think that way anyway? This is what you should be thinking, right? And then when you get to therapeutics, which I hear a lot, you actually remember a lot of this stuff. So it helps you tremendously in therapeutics, okay? So I talk about the chemistry where it's applicable, and I talk about how they work and the drug interactions and why you want to take one versus another, okay? We're all on the same page. You guys know how to study and you know what to expect, right? Any other questions? Okay, so since today is the last day, I was really hoping that I had Wednesday too, because I had some cool stuff to do with you guys, but oh well, I guess I don't have Wednesday. Just so I have to go upside this morning. So because I don't have Wednesday, we're going to talk about insomnia, and we're going to talk about the different drugs that are available to treat insomnia. Now, in the medical community, a lot of people kind of think insomnia is not really a true disease. And so, like, there are people that only want to have limited drug molecules, for example, on their formulary to try and treat this because they don't truly believe it's a big disease. And this is a big misnomer out there. Insomnia is a significant problem among Americans. And do you think that if you can't sleep that well, you're going to be able to perform significantly? No, okay? It's going to affect no matter what you do. And so the problem out there in the United States and worldwide, I would say, is it's kind of culturally acceptable that you just pop a pill for everything and no big deal, you know? No big deal, okay, right? Remember what killed Heath Ledger, among other things? A couple years ago? You guys know? All right, I'm thinking. I don't think I remember. But the only one here. My sister was devastated. She loved it. Drugs you don't mix, right? Because it could cause respiratory arrest. The biggest problem out there with these types of medications is what? Guess what? Interactions, that's big, okay? But what's the biggest problem besides that? What? Addiction, right? People feel like they actually need it to function, okay? These types of aids are only meant to be used short-term. We're going to talk about a few that you can use long-term, but even the long-term agents, you don't want to be on the rest of your life, right? So how do you get around that? How do you help people get around that? Sorry, Gary, you're relegated to taking this the rest of your life, right? We already know we don't want to take these drugs the rest of your life. We don't even want to take them long-term, right? So what types of things tend to cause insomnia? Stress is a big one, okay? There's lots of things that could cause insomnia. I mean, stress, it could be people exercising late at night, they could be smoking, they could be taking caffeine-type products. There's lots of things. But what you have to do is you have to try and counsel patients to figure out and change their ways so that they can kind of get ready to wind down at the end of the day and decrease their thoughts and worries, etc., to get ready for sleep, because the brain does need sleep. Now, this old notion that, for example, oh, your great-great-grandmother said that you drink some warm milk or whatever and then you go to sleep is really not sound, because they've done studies on it, and the notion is saying you could be sent for eating, well, turkey dinner, right, during Thanksgiving. And the problem is that it's related to the synthesis of serotonin. Well, your body has a lot of regulation in it. And it doesn't just say, okay, I'm going to take every ounce of tryptophan and make as much serotonin as possible or various neurotransmitters. There's regulatory mechanisms in place. And so they've actually looked at the study and said that they really, it's not correlated with that. But insomnia is a billion-dollar industry. So I think it's in the United States, like close to a $3 billion industry alone. And there are half of all Americans experience some sort of sleep problems. And not everybody's on medication, obviously, but you have other types of like things going on. You have sleep apnea. Has anybody ever heard of this? Okay, so what's this? You can stop breathing multiple times a night, right? And guess what this is directly correlated with? Higher incidence of, what's the number one epidemic right now? Obesity, right? So you're going to have a lot more people suffer from that, okay? And there are things that you can do to try and avoid it. RLS, what's that? Restless leg syndrome, so that could lead to that. But in by far, insomnia is what affects the most people. And so you want to try and figure out what it is that's affecting them. Now, sedative, hypnotic, it's all going to be dependent on dose. And all of these drugs that I'm going to talk about today can affect your normal sleep patterns. And you can read about normal sleep patterns. But the premise is that you don't want to take most of these agents for more than 10 days. We're going to talk about Rosam and Lunesta, how you can take those longer. Obviously, than 10 days, but you're still not going to want people taking it very, very long term. You've got to be really careful, though, about drug interactions with these guys, because anytime you take a CNS depressant, or commonly like alcohol or other types of products, you should never do that because it could, the effects can be additive and very, very dangerous. So you want to be extremely careful. Okay. There's lots of things that could make an ideal hypnotic. Obviously, you want them to be safe. You don't want them to be addicting. You don't want to develop tolerance. And also, you don't want to have the next day grogginess feeling by trying to take it, which actually some of the drugs do have. And so we're going to talk about that addiction potential, tolerance potential, next day grogginess, etc. All right. One of the oldest drugs that was used insomnia, it actually still is. I mean, it was widely used in the 50s and 60s, it was the best they had at that time to try and resemble the natural sleep patterns, and it didn't mess up the REM sleep as much as other drugs did, was chlorohydrate. And you still find some usefulness for it today, sometimes in the elderly patients, sometimes in pediatric patients, but this has been used for a very long time. And what I want to point out is that this is the drug that, have you ever watched old movies and you hear the term Vicky Finn being used? Yep, it's chlorohydrate and alcohol pretty much combined that makes this Vicky Finn. And what happens to people that are given Vicky Finn? Has anybody seen old movies?
No.
Vicky Finn? Then somebody, nobody, yeah, they'll like pass out or something because you're mixing the additive effects. You gotta be really careful. Those can be very dangerous. And what we're gonna talk about is a metabolite known as trichloroethanol. And actually, with this one, this is what trichloroethanol looks like. And when you have chloro, you make chlorohydrate. It can dissociate back. And actually, it's not really the chlorohydrate that actually causes this sedative effect. It's actually how it gets metabolized in the body to significantly this trichloroethanol. So it's actually the trichloroethanol that's eliciting its sedative effects. Now, this drug can also get metabolized to trichloroacetic acid. What type of toxicity might you think might be associated with this? Some kind of cytotoxicity, so you have to be careful about which types of patients you do give it to. But this is what it looks like, and where most of the activity comes from this metabolite here. It has unpleasant properties when you give it orally, so that's the problem. It's associated with some liver damage, some withdrawal, comes in lots of different forms. And you might be thinking to yourself, well, if it gets metabolized to this trichloral ethanol, and if it's the trichloral ethanol that's actually responsible for elicitating its effect, why would you not want to just take trichloral ethanol instead of taking chlorohydrate? The reason is because trichloral ethanol given by itself has a very bad odor, taste to it, and it's very irritating. So that's why you don't want to do that. All right. There's another drug called triclose, and this one isn't really used as much. It's a prodrug, and pretty much it's going to increase the water solubility properties. They're trying to come up with a less irritating drug relative to trichloral ethanol. So like this came right after chlorohydrate. And basically, it did improve the the solubility properties of it. And it still gets metabolized to trichloral ethanol, which is still going to work the same way as chlorohydrate. And it comes in lots of different forms. It's just another alternative, I guess. Pyraldehyde, this is another sedative that can be used. It's kind of a polyether type structure, if you will, and not that soluble because it's very lipophilic, and it has a very strong odor with unpleasant taste, okay? So this is not ideal for people to want to take it. That's why you've probably never heard of it, but it's kind of relegated to more or less institutional settings, and this is usually what's used to try and help patients that suffer from alcohol with delirium tremors and stuff as a sedative, and it's used commonly in institutional settings. But we, out in the public, don't usually ever come in contact with that. So the ones we're going to spend most of the time talking about today are the ones we all know by name. And we're also going to get into a number of the benzodiazepine derivatives. And so I'm sure that Dr. Lovestead has already talked to you about this. Not sure if she really taught you relative to. This is a very old building. I don't want to get stuck in it. But we're going to talk about some newer drugs on the market, or that will be coming down the pipeline, some of the ones that are being used. But anyway, it used to be that physicians would sometimes dispense benzodiazepines a lot to try and help people that suffered from insomnia, but we went through a portion in medical history that physicians got kind of really scared using the benzodiazepine derivatives because of the obvious drawbacks from using it. So, you know, tolerance, withdrawal, dependence, abuse, sedation, or next day grogginess affected a lot of your behavioral changes. And so they got really scared, and so you went from using significant portions of benzodiazepines to using, guess what, drug. What's the number one OTC agent used to probably treat insomnia? Benadryl. So Benadryl was used for so long after that, before the non-benzodiazepine derivatives came out on the market. But remember, you have to try and treat the problem, not the symptoms, because you can't treat the symptoms forever. Like whether your problem is obesity, whether it's stress-related, whether it's exercising or drinking caffeine drinks, whatever it is, you have to try and, you know, counsel patients to eliminate the stressors and move away from what's actually causing their insomnia, or you're not going to counsel them that well because they can't be on these drugs. But nonetheless, we're going to cover all the ones that have been used. Dalmay, obviously, is a benzodiazepine derivative, and it can be used. It says it doesn't affect REM. All of these drugs will affect REM sleep to some degree. It could be very mild. It could be more severe. Relative to what they had available, it doesn't affect REM sleep So your benzodiazepines will affect REM sleep more so than your agents like Ambien, Sonata, Rosarum, stuff like that. So keep in mind, even if it says it does not affect REM, it still affects it somewhat. You want drugs that are going to affect REM sleep to the least extent. You want drugs that are going to have a fast onset. That's the advantage of this one. If you had drugs that had a very long onset, what's the point in giving it to somebody because they're having problems falling asleep or staying asleep? So we care a lot about the onset and then the duration. If you had a drug that had a duration of 10 hours, might that be a good thing? No, because how many people just get to lay in the bed all day and sleep, right? We don't get to sleep that long, so they're going to get up and they're going to be really groggy. You can have, especially if you have older people, they could have hip fractures, etc. So we worry about the duration as well. This one has a pretty good duration of 7 to 8 hours, so you don't have to worry as much about people waking up early in the throughout the night and can't sleep again. But you're not going to want to use it with children or pregnant women, and this goes without saying with your benzodiazepines. All right, calcium. This one's actually a really unique one because low doses of this drug are pretty safe to use, but actually if you start increasing the dose of this one, it becomes not so safe. That's why actually various countries in the world have withdrawn it and they won't even use it. You can still use it in the U.S., but only the low doses are recommended because like in Britain, they won't even use it because the toxicity doesn't, the benefit doesn't outweigh the risk of using it because of toxicity, but low doses are effective and can be used with relatively good safety profiles. But that's partly the reason in the early 90s why physicians got so scared using these benzodiazepines because of the depression, the tolerance and stuff like that that went associated with behavioral changes. Some people had suicidal thoughts, etc. So that's why they kind of more or less gave up on them for some degree of time and went to Benadryl. This one has a very fast onset, which is like what we like to see in a relatively short half-life of 3 hours. So you're not going to have any sort of morning drowsiness that you do see with a lot of the other drugs. Sometimes you have to understand what types of patients you're treating. Some people only have problems just getting to sleep, okay? So actually the shortest duration would be, the drug with the shortest duration would be ideal for them because they're going to have the lowest chance of next day grogginess. Some people have problems staying asleep. If they have problems staying asleep, you're going to want one with a longer duration of action. Otherwise, if you give them something like this, they can get to sleep and then they're going to wake up shortly thereafter and be like, okay, let's count the cows jumping over the moon or something. You know, like they're not going to be very happy. So you got to keep your eye on like what your patient needs. Okay. Restoril is another commonly used one. This one, all of these are supposed to be used for short-term treatment. This one's actually very cheap, and it's used a lot. Like, you're not going to use any of these for more than 7 to 10 days. Half-life on this is going to be a lot longer, 8 to 10 hours, so you're going to have some residual grogginess with this one because of the half-life on this one. You're not going to give it to any kids under the age of 18. And overall, though, one at low doses, it's pretty safe. It's inexpensive. It's very effective and cheap. This one was used for a long time before your Ambien, for example, or Sonata came out. So this has pretty much been replaced by the newer agents, but it's still used a lot in some hospital settings. You're never ever going to give this to anybody though that has ever had a problem with drug problems, alcohol abuse, etc. Because you're not sure, why would you never want to give it, first of all, to somebody like that? If you know that they have maybe an alcohol problem or drug problem or whatever other types of problems. Yeah, and what's the problem? The additive effects, right? And remember, all of these drugs will cause some degree of respiratory depression, right? So if you start mixing them, and if you take other CNS depressants, that could be lethal, depending upon the dose that you take. And so it's going to decrease your blood pressure, it's going to decrease your breathing rate, and it could potentially be dangerous. Dependence potential, though, on this one is higher, and so you got to be careful, too, because people that have a dependence issue, like if they have an alcohol problem or drug problem or have had them, they have, they're more prone to drugs that are have more dependence issues, so they would become dependent on this one pretty quickly. But overall, pretty safe at lower doses. Okay. It is associated with some kidney and liver problems, but it's dose-dependent. By far, your most popular OTC agent to use for treating insomnia, which was used and still is used quite frequently, is Benadryl. Now, most people think Benadryl perfectly fine, right? Well, not necessarily, okay? Benadryl does have some drawbacks. You see it used a lot with people, obviously, that want to drug their kids, you know, go on plane rides and stuff, so their kids kind of calm down or whatever. But a lot of other people use it. So this can have a lot of next-day grogginess if you take it at higher doses. So you'll have a hard time waking up in the morning, and you'll feel like you're dragging the rest of the day. If you take it in lower doses, you will feel fine, and you can take advantage of its side effects. The biggest group of people you got to be really careful, I'm not sure if you've learned this in other classes, is that one of the side effects of Benadryl also is hypertension. It'll increase your blood pressure. So it's not going to do it significantly, but you wouldn't want anybody that's on a hypertensive agent or has problems with high blood pressure to take Benadryl. You guys known that or been taught that before? No? Okay. So you obviously just have to be careful who is going to take it. Now, 50 milligrams, that's a lot of milligrams to take. So those people might be experiencing more residual sedative effects in the morning and drowsiness. All right. So our non-benzodiazepine sedative hypnotics are the ones we're going to focus on a little bit more in the last 20 minutes or so we have. First one is Ambien. This was the first one that came out, and also it's the one that pretty much owns the market. Why do you think it does? It's, why is it cheaper? Is it generic? Yeah, okay. And also it's pretty potent, okay? Relative to Sonata, Sonata is not as potent as Ambien, and so Ambien is very effective, very potent, and it holds more than half of the market in the drug. It's used for short-term insomnia. This is key. You're not supposed to use this for more than 7 to 10 days. Maybe if you can't get control of it, the physician should extend it a little bit more than that. But you have people taking this for like 3 or 4 months. This is very bad. You shouldn't have people taking this for more than 7 to 10 days. And they shouldn't need to depend on it in order to get to sleep. This is extremely bad. The problem we're going to run into talking about these agents is that insurance, of course, it always comes back to insurance, because insurance is going to be problematic because they're not going to want to pay for necessarily the right drugs for some patients. Have you guys, for example, I know I'm talking about it before we've actually introduced it, but have you guys heard of Rosera? Okay, Rosera is a great drug. We're going to talk about how it's very great and it's perfect for some people. But like even though Rosera was so great, would work very well for them, insurance isn't going to allow them to pay for it. So they're relegated to, okay, well, your insurance will pay for Ambien. That doesn't mean that they need to be or should be on Ambien long term. You should never have somebody on Ambien long term. So make sure you pay attention to that, because obviously people come to you to get their prescriptions refilled. Sonata is another one we're going to talk about, but we're going to talk about each one independently. Okay, so structurally, these don't look like the benzodiazepines, and Ambien is used, it's very effective, and it resembles natural sleep patterns much, much better than the benzodiazepines did. They have very quick onset. Remember, the drugs that are going to be the best in this category are the ones that are going to not mess up your REM sleep that much. And so that is going to be very ideal. You obviously want them to have a rapid onset, hence Ambien does, in a shorter duration. than the benzodiazepines, because oftentimes your benzos have longer durations and they have residual effects because of that. But this one is pretty good, and it's rapidly absorbed. You don't have as much with first pass effect, so for example, roughly around 20% is going to be metabolized by a first pass. That'll decrease the side effects. You can have mild rebound insomnia from taking Ambien milk, so the first night, first week, etc. So you can also feel like you do have some dependence on Ambien. There is dependence potential there. And there are lower next day grogginess effects on Ambien, but it's still present. Okay, what else do I want to say? Reduced ability to cause physical dependence. But dependence has been reported, it is seen, so that's important. Rapid onset, 15 to 30 minutes, that's ideal. Short elimination half-life of around 2.5 hours. So, who might this be the best for? People that what? Getting to sleep, right? What about people that have problems staying asleep? Would this be the best one for them? No, because of the shorter half-life, right? Do you think someone wants to take something, wake up, oh, can't sleep again, okay, get up, take another dose, like they're not going to want to have to do that. No rebound effects upon withdrawal of the drug. There is some small chance of rebound effects, but it's so low that they say that it's no rebound effects. Okay, there's also Ambien CR, and so what is that? Controlled release, right? So you think it's pretty much the same thing. It's just the controlled release. All right, so there are advantages to using Ambien. You can read through these, but we are going to compare it now to Sonata. So this is another derivative. Remember, you don't have to be memorizing structures here. And relative to SAR, it's hard to say this is the SAR for the insomnia medications. Ambien and Sonata are pretty similar because you see this ring here. But in the newer ones, you're not going to see this. So there really isn't a significant clinical SAR to point to and say, okay, you're going to design these drugs this way. Okay, a lot of these things bind to GABA, and that's how they're going to work. But the structure to them can differ significantly, and that's why we're going to see big structural differences between the ones we're going to talk about today. All right, so Sonata, this is the newest one relative to Ambien. And Sonata can be taken pretty much when you want to go to sleep or after if you can't fall asleep. It's going to have a little bit less of that residual effects the next morning because of the short half-life, and that's going to be an advantage to this one. Obviously, this one's going to be better versus the benzodiazepines. And the half-life on this one is, did I give it to you? The half-life on this is roughly an hour, okay? So what does that tell you relative to Ambien? Shorter half-life. And it's also half as potent as Ambien. So if you're a physician and you have the choice of writing out Ambien or Sonata, that's why Ambien oftentimes gets written out instead of Sonata. Okay, so you can read through these. We're not going to have enough time, and I don't have patience to read through this for you. You can do this. You all are intelligent to learn the additional aspects of it. Okay. Side effects, headache, drowsiness. Obviously, the drowsiness is what you're trying to take advantage of, but the excess drowsiness is what you're going to try and stay away from. Dose. Make sure you be careful, though, about the elderly, because what did I teach you guys, especially last semester, about elderly patients? Yeah, so hepatically, might you have to adjust the dose with them? Right, so you want them on the lower dose because they're prone to decreases in liver function. And they can stay in their systems longer. And so what do you know about older people? This isn't an absolute, but by and large, older people do what? Relative to sleep. That's what we're talking about. early and they still have residual effects, then they could, you know, fall, you know, crack a hip, break a bone, right? And that's a very common problem. So the risk of falling, you don't want that to be great because of the residual grogginess effects of taking these types of agents. But Sonata won't increase sleep duration. Okay. Obviously, you want to pay attention to how much sleep you're going to have, because if you have a drug that has a longer duration and you're not able to sleep, obviously you're going to be groggy and being behind the wheel. You could also get in an accident as well. There are good people that have done that. Actually, CMS is talking about ambient Sonata. I have to bring up this article that I found pretty interesting. They were talking about sleep aids to warn of odd side effects. So, the title of this is Patients Report Eating, Driving, Having Sex While Sleeping. And this is actually true, okay? There are a small percentage of people that take these types of drugs. Ambien's very popular, Lovest is another one, and they experience bizarre nighttime effects. For example, there's a lady that just kept gaining weight and kept gaining weight. She would exercise and, I don't know, do Weight Watchers or whatever she did, and she just kept gaining weight, and she's like, what the heck's going on? So they actually videotaped the woman and found out that in the middle of the night, she wakes up, and she goes to her refrigerator, and she just, like, eats all this food, tons and tons of food. Then she, like, goes back to the bed and sleeps. I don't personally know how you wouldn't notice that the next day when you're like, what happened to all my food? But, you know, nonetheless, she would just eat, 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 eat. There are people that have been reported getting up, cooking, etc. Yeah.
I actually have a personal friend who was on, I think it was Sonata, he drank a beer at night and woke up in jail the next morning. He was arrested for a DUI. Has no recollection of the whole thing. And the police, I mean, he was on video of his sobriety test and everything, and he has no recollection of any of it.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that goes on. So, I mean, it's not meaning everyone's going to experience it, but a small percentage of the population that takes these drugs experience these crazy, you know, side effects. Now, that doesn't mean that you can say, oh, great, I get to go cheat on my wife or my spouse, and then I'll blame the Ambien or the Lovest. That's going to be, like, over very well. But you should know and be able to counsel patients that there have been these bizarre behaviors that do go on. And so it was actually really interesting. They still don't know why it's happening, and some people are more prone to different types of odd behavior. Some people will get up in the middle of the night and, like, Jason, right? What's your name again?
What's that?
What's your name again?
Jeremy.
You know, it started with a J. I was close. They will, like, get in the car. Now, that's freaky, right? Because what if you're driving home from the library or something, and then this Jerry comes along, and he's sleeping, and he could run right into you, right? Not good. All right, I'm trying to hustle because we don't have much time. I feel like I haven't even got to the newer ones yet. I mean, the newer ones relative to this one. Mm-hmm. All right, so you can read through this, and when doctors choose between Ambien and Sonata, they pretty much choose Ambien, but be careful. You don't want patients taking it longer than 7 to 10 days. All right, roughly in 05, then Lunesta came up, and this was the first one now that could be used for long-term treatment. So this is, and this one clearly, clinically, helped people stay asleep. So if you were somebody that had a big problem with staying asleep, you could take Lunesta, and it would help you stay asleep. This is obviously a non-benzodiazepine drug, and it doesn't lose its effectiveness over time. So that's another advantage. But the downside is you have to at least have 8 hours of sleep. You're not going to have a lot of dependency potential with this one. Some people say that there's no dependence taking Lunesta. They're wrong. There still is some minor dependence with potential with taking Lunesta. There's no dependence potential taking Rosarin, but there still is a low incidence. It's so low that a lot of people say that there's no dependence issues with Lunesta. But when you read the clinical research out there, there is still a slight dependency of people becoming dependent on it. But it's very effective. Comes in 1, 2, 3. If you're an elderly patient, you're going to put them on the lower end of the spectrum. and started out low, and then you could increase their dose. The biggest thing with lunestab, besides obviously the advantages and disadvantages, is you're going to make sure people know that they don't want to take this with like fast food or potato chips or anything that has a lot of fat in it, because what happens is if you do that, it can actually mess up the absorption, and what it'll do is it'll slow the absorption and reduce the effects of the drug. And this goes with most of your non-benzodiazepine drugs. You're not going to want to take it with like your, you know, stuff that you're going to consume a lot of fat. Alright, side effects. Don't stop taking abruptly because it could lead to withdrawal. So like for example, if you're on a higher dose, you just slowly titrate yourself or get yourself off. Now, the next one, structurally, doesn't look anything like Lunesta or Ambien or Sonata or the benzodiazepines, is a drug called Rosera. So this is one of the newest ones that are available. And this one is not going to bind to GABA at all, like your other ones did. This one's a melatonin receptor agonist. And so it binds to melatonin receptors, inhibiting the firing so that's keeping you awake. And so this one is actually a fantastic drug. It's quickly absorbed. It will still have the issues with absorption like Lunesta did if you take it with a fat meal. So just don't take it with a fatty type meal because it'll increase the decrease the absorption. But this one, the biggest advantage to this one is you can take it long term. Very, very good drug. There's no dependence, there's no tolerance, and there's no overdose that has been reported in clinical studies and development with this one. Sometimes you'll have pharmacists that'll say, you know, for example, their insurance won't cover Rosera, okay? You don't want them taking long-term Ambien. Their insurance might cover Lunesta, great, you put them on Lunesta. Rarely do insurances want to pay for this, so you will sometimes have pharmacists recommend what? This is a, how does this one work?
It's like a herbal melatonin.
Pardon?
Herbal melatonin supplement.
Exactly. So they're going to say take melatonin. And so that's very commonly recommended to try and get around this, because this one is the only one so far that has a completely different mechanism in that it binds to melatonin. But it's a very, very good and safe exception, if you will, if you're trying to move away from Ambien or Sonata and trying to take something long term. It has a very good profile. Endoflin. This one is a Pfizer drug that's being investigated, and it's being investigated with Ambien in mind, because this one's going to be 10 times as potent as Ambien, and you're not going to have to take as much, so the side effects and the drug interactions are going to be very, very little. But this one's going to act on GABA receptors like Ambien will, and it's actually very, very similar to Ambien, except it's more powerful, and so you can decrease the dose of this. And you'll fall asleep faster taking this relative to Ambien because it's so much more potent and it works faster. The difference between Endoflin and Ambien, though, is this one's now going to be safe to use long-term. So you have people on Ambien taking it long-term, whereas they really, really shouldn't, but they could take Endoflin. It would work the same way, and it would actually give a better result, and they can take it long-term. It would be safe for that. And it's going to have a short half-life, and that's a good one. There's also another one that actually I think is going to get dumped by Merck, actually. But this one was looking, the structure is very simple to make, but they were looking at it. It's another GABA agonist, but it was supposed to give us another alternative. But this one's probably not going to make it. All right. Dr. Lovestead will talk to you about the antihistamines whenever she gets to them. Not really sure if she got to them yet. Not yet? Okay. So I'm not going to talk about the antihistamines, except the only one that I wanted you to know was Benadryl relative to insomnia. Let's make sure I don't have anything at the end. Thank you. Have a